Okay, Mark, thanks for joining us here at Inside the Edit, mate.
Oh, a pleasure.
I think one of the first things our members will be very interested in is how you actually got started in the industry.
Started via catering, making tea, getting the sandwiches. And then you go, oh, God, I'm in catering. I wanted to make films. And then slowly you get to digitise. So I just missed film. And it was still non-linear, but there were tapes. It was a lot simpler. Now it's really complicated.
So did you start off at an edit facility or...?
Yeah, in an edit facility in Manchester. So I studied media because I wanted to make... Well, if I go way back, my dad got a video camera when I was 13 and I started making films with my friends and editing in camera, you know, where you just stop it and start it and move the camera about. And then so I sort of thought, oh, I like this. And A-level, you couldn't really do anything like that as A-level, so I went to college and did a two-year course at Norwich. And then from there I went to Manchester and did a two-year course. I went to Manchester because it was really practical and you got to make stuff. Mm. So I ended up in Manchester at a facility after college. You know, got my big break making tea. And, yeah, it was all they did there, they didn't do anything scripted. It was all, like, items for magazine shows. I mean, really, the trajectory is you start cutting short form, very short things, items for shows, small news pieces, and then you slowly go, oh, can you be trusted with a whole half hour? Mm. And then you start to get a few half hours, and then people decide that you might be able to handle cutting a whole hour. And it just, yeah, moves on from there, really. And I think I left after I got my first 3 broadcast credits and moved to London.
What was the first moment when you started switching from making tea to someone's like, oh, can you try cutting this?
All my major breaks have been from people being ill. Because nobody's, like, falling over themselves to give you, go, oh, you're special. I'm going to give you a go, you know. Because while you're good at making the tea and getting the sandwiches, you'll stay there. Because I remember reading that Robert Evans book, and he says success is preparation meeting opportunity. Mm. So while you're waiting for opportunity, you need to prepare for, you know, the day when somebody's ill and you have to sit in the hot seat, because there's no point getting that break and you can't do the job. Mm. So I was, like, making music videos, editing my own, you know, I sort of shot my own documentary about my band. And so I was cutting things and doing stuff. You know, I knew how to operate and had some skills. And I think the first time I went from being the tea boy to a junior editor was the day it was Ian Wilson was the editor this day. I think he still edits in Manchester, and his eye just really swelled up strangely, so that he was like, oh mate, you're gonna have to do this. His eye was out here. And it was like, it was a special job where I had to come in at 8 a.m. and I was the only person in the facility, so I had to do it, and I did it, and then that became my gig from there on in. And then I was doing more and more stuff, but it takes somebody being ill really to get a break. It's tough.
You went from a couple of minutes sort of VTs type thing to a half hour to an hour. And then you moved to London and it just sort of blossomed from there. Did you get an agent? How did it work?
I think start off, I just like did the leap of faith, because I thought Manchester was so small that everyone asked for the same 5 editors whenever anyone was trying to book anyone. Mm. So I sort of thought, oh God, you know, as long as those guys are around, I'll never get a look in. Which is probably not true, because you just work your way up and get your own, make your own reputation. So I moved to London, and I was lucky enough that I'd cut a taster tape back in Manchester. And the series had been commissioned, and the director wanted me to cut it. And he was like, oh, the only thing is it's editing in London. And I was like, well, I've just moved. Great. Mm. And that was like 3 half hours for BBC One. So that was like a big thing as well. Yeah. So I had about 7 years of cutting docs. Mm. And then one day somebody else was ill who was cutting a comedy pilot, and they were just after anyone. You know, just
desperate.
A, yeah, last just a minute. Warm body. Yeah, literally, it's that, just anyone. And I think somebody suggested me. I'm like, Mark, he's anyone. I think somebody knew that I wanted to do comedy. And they got me in. And then I finished the job. And they got me back for a comedy pilot. And then I did another comedy pilot with them. And then I was cutting Peep Show quite quickly, which is obviously a really good show. It wasn't as famous at the time, but Series 3. And that was my big break, really. Because I think it was... the producer of the pilot obviously saw something in me, because I wasn't proven at all in comedy.
Mm.
I don't know what it was, but you know.
So you really weren't lying at all when it's like, actually, there's been quite a few occasions in your career when you jumped in when someone was ill.
I know. And that just goes to show, you know, dead man's shoes. And, you know, I'm not advocating poisoning people. definitely don't. You just got to hope that people come ill of their own accord.
I mean, just stepping back, what actually attracted you to editing, you know, fundamentally, and you're not directing, not anything, you know, producing, camera, anything like that? What was the thing about editing that you got most attracted to?
Well, like when I made like my early films, to be honest, it was the buzz of when you'd shot something and sort of seeing it come to life and come together. Because I think editing is the point where it all comes together, because before that, it's not watchable, it's not the end product, you know. Yeah. A script is just a script, it's not literature, it's not a film. So I think it was experiencing that. Admittedly, it was a bit of a buzz of putting together what I had done. So I think at that point, I still wanted to be a director. And then I read Scorsese on Scorsese, and he said all directors should be editors first. It doesn't seem to work out. But he was my idol at college, and well, you know, he's still pretty good.
Just a little bit.
Yeah, he's still all right, isn't he? I don't know, he's getting better, isn't he? Yeah, and I thought, well, I'll become an editor then. Scorsese says so.
So, I mean, you started off cutting docs, and then you moved into drama and comedy drama. That's a really interesting path, and it's quite well trodden in the industry, but. You know, what do you think the main differences are in between documentary and drama and going from one to the other, you know, the kind of processes that you go through as an editor?
I mean, before you go artistically, they're two different worlds completely. And like, it's quite difficult to make the transition for a lot of people because people only want somebody who's already basically done what they're asking them to do. It's tough to transition and it's tough to get a break. Because what people are looking for is, you know, they want to see a CV full of loads of things very similar to the job they're going to give you. Artistically, like, it was really good to have done loads of docs. What I don't miss from documentaries that, to a point, I started to get a bit bored of was the thing is, because you are entirely crafting it, you're sort of writing it in the edit suite, because, you know, you've got a load of rushes, you've got the idea of a story, that the commissioner comes in, watches it, and just goes, no, I want you to completely re-spin the story. You know, and with 2 weeks to go before lock, you have to just completely recut the whole thing and replace all the voiceover and re-spin it. Whereas you don't get that as much in scripted, because there's a script. You've got that to work to. Although there's loads of other things with nuance and all, you know, it is different, and you still get nightmares.
Different types of nightmares.
Yeah, I mean, the weird thing with docs is you feel almost like you're creating something out of nothing, because it's, well, you've got no blueprint, you know, something scripted is designed, and then the various flaws of that design will become apparent. Documentaries is quite a lot of work in it as well, because you're really creating, you feel like you're creating a lot more.
It's kind of like you're like the sort of retrospective screenwriter, as it were.
Yeah, yeah. Also, you'll have way more rushes generally, hours and hours of rushes. And so that just in itself leaves it open to wider interpretation and possibilities.
Mm. A lot of editors you talk to, they say, what I'm taking and crafting wasn't specifically shot for my purposes. Whereas with a drama, a lot of the thought process has been done before by the screenwriter, the director, the cinematographer, etc.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot more flexibility to go in a direction that the people don't like as well. You know, because you just go, oh, we've gone for this element and we're trying to go this way, and we're, you know, and then the commissioning editor comes in and goes, no, I don't like that. Oh, well, that took us 3 weeks to do that bit of it. Well, now why doesn't he? What about the bit where he went here and a bit more of that part of his life? Yeah. Okay, back to the drawing board. Where is that 5 hours of rushes where he went here? Oh, okay. And sometimes you have to cut something to see whether there's anything there. I've had that on things, and you spend a few days cutting something and go, do you know what? I don't think we need this bit.
Mm.
Whereas, but, you know, you also get that in scripted things as well. But you know, you probably won't have 5 hours rushes to go through.
Mm. It's that huge act of compression, isn't it?
Yeah, the whittling. Yeah, I mean, it is. I used to joke about like not wanting to be called an editor, wanting to be called an audiovisual sculptor, because it is like, especially with docs, it's sort of chipping away, you know, and it's just refining it and getting it down and just slowly distilling it, and that's what takes a long while. And there's generally less rushes on scripted things with focused setups, so you're just dealing with less. And I like documentaries. But the weird thing is, I don't think they sort of go... It's not something that sort of goes hand in hand. And I think it's quite rare that people go, oh, I'm doing a documentary this week, I'm doing a scripted next week. I think you sort of have to choose a direction in a way. That's what I think you have to do. Yeah, it's a great thing to have done. But from a career point of view, if you want to do drama, like, you're probably best off starting off doing drama because you'll get pigeonholed and you'll have to break out. You'll have another load of skills from doing docs, but it's not necessarily help you in a career path.
Skills and abilities versus the realities of the industry and how people pigeonhole you are two kind of different things, really, aren't they?
Yeah. You'll just get judged on what you've done and you'll get more of what you've done.
Yeah.
So the challenge is always, if you don't want to do what you've done, how do you get that other, the break, you know? And it's difficult. But it's mainly will be down to personal relationships. You know, if you work with a director who goes from one thing to another, or, you know, or like I say, from people being ill.
Someone being ill. So, I mean, you've worked on some of the biggest comedy shows that have come out of the UK, you know, definitely over the last 5-10 years. That has been one of your sort of mainstays. What are the main kind of skills that you think are specific for crafting and cutting comedy?
When I was less experienced, I remember sort of working with, I think it was Tristram Shapiro and some really good, you know, people with a lot more experience than me, and they give you notes. Like, it's a sort of dark process of making something funnier, and it takes a while to get into that mindset. But, you know, I used to like making things funny in docs, and I was I think I've got a sense of humour. I think that's quite important. I think if you're a really serious person, I think it's not for you. Like, everyone I know who works in comedy likes a laugh. You know, even if you're not a comic genius, you can still be a joker. You know, everyone tells bad jokes. And, yeah, no, going back to just seeing somebody, you know, seeing these notes, and it's like a weird X factor of watching something get funnier. And you go, oh, what's that? We're just tweaking the timing, but it's getting funnier, you know. That's sort of an amazing thing. Obviously, a lot of it's down to comic timing. And it's odd when you work on different things and you've got people who are comic performers who are like actors who have never been comedians, and then you get comedians who are the actors. The people who are performers and comics who have gone, you know, have been on the stage and worked rooms, like, their sense of timing and what's funny is generally pretty astonishing. And what a lot of people will want to see is that their timing, you know, in the edit. Like, what was their timing like? You know what I mean? Like, you just, one of the notes is, what was it like originally? And you go, no, that is their timing. I've kept their timing. You know, people who have worked rooms for years, they've got it. And the great thing is, sometimes they haven't always. And the great thing is when you can help it and you go, I've made that a bit better. You know, it's to sort of help when it's needed.
Just like compressing or decompressing those few frames at that specific point.
Well, it's also, there's a weird thing of sometimes their timing is great on the day in itself, but it all needs a bit, and it's sort of judging that really in the pace of the show. From having worked with people who haven't done comedy and sort of have had things assembled for you by people who haven't worked in comedy or mainly do drama, that often makes you realise of what you do that you don't realise. Like, I remember somebody assembling things for me, and you just go, oh, well, right, the reason that needs to be cut a different way is because, like, the joke is this, and then we see the person and you laugh. And you go, and, you know, and it's just literally asking yourself, what is this joke?
Yeah.
And is this joke a reveal? You know, I want to hear the person say this. We cut to them. You know, what's the joke? I guess the thing in comedy that you really, you know, you the jokes are the stars, and you want to make those jokes land. But there's a rhythm to it, and you want it to be as funny as possible rather than sort of gloss over it.
It's funny what you're saying, actually. I thought that was really interesting about, is that one of the notes you get from sort of more senior producers and stuff like that when they say, what was the natural timing? What was their natural rhythm of delivery? Mm. And they want to see that as opposed to an edited version of that delivery. Well, is that a common thing?
Well, if they're happy with it, there's generally not. And the other thing is sometimes you will entirely construct the rhythm of something. You'll entirely, it'll be a complete construct because it'll be from a number of different takes that you'll be putting together all the performances. When on Paddington in particular, the bear isn't real.
Mm. It's not real?
No, he's not real.
Oh, no. I mean, you just destroyed everything for me.
He's
then,
not huh? there. And, but the other thing is Ben Whishaw wasn't even there. Half the time the dialogue had been changed later. And that takes some time to get him to feel like he's there and the rhythm's right. And, you know, it isn't just leave a gap, record it, job's a good one. Mm. You know, it's like tweaking and tweaking to get it to feel like a real rhythm. So, you know, I'm not saying that you will, to do comedy, just do what the performer's done. But quite a big note will often be, what was their original timing? And then so you play it back and either they go, their timing's perfect. Or they go, yeah, it needs a bit of work. Yeah, okay, let's try it. But that's the thing that comes up, is just checking you haven't ruined the comic's brilliant timing.
You know, what's in terms of your sort of workflow, you know, from the ground up, you know, you talk to a lot of young editors and they want to know what's that first step when constructing a scene. I mean, specifically like a dialogue scene, when you first look at those rushes and you first, you know, what are the first things you're looking for? And how do you go about constructing it? Do you look for actors' performance first, or what's the first thing that attracts your eye?
Well, I guess the first thing is, so you'll have all your rushes in the nicely put into a bin by your assistant, and then you get these notes, the script supervisor, you know, so you'll have all the different takes, how many of them are there, you know, which ones are just no good. Mm. You know, in the end, you'll look at all the takes, because who knows which
you never know what you're
lines
find.
Yeah. You never know which lines from other takes are great, but quite often you go, unless you've got buckets of time, you'll just look at what seem to be the best takes. Mm. And inevitably you get these, you know, you get the notes and they've got, you know, this take and selects on it, and then sometimes the director comes in and goes, oh, you haven't paid any attention to that, have you, the best select takes, go, I don't know which was, you know, we don't know which was the best, but, you know, it's not a bad thing to start with. And I guess, I don't know, I mean, the problem is all scenes are different, aren't they? So it's tough to say how you approach each scene. You know, I guess it's the first thing is to assess what's the key to the scene. So it's difficult to sort of have a, you know, universal way of approaching a scene.
Does it vary a lot with action scenes? Obviously, with action, there's a very specific type of sequential nature to it, and it's got to have this at this certain point, as opposed to performance and stuff like that. How does it differ for you?
I don't know. Action scenes are quite fun to do, really, because there's usually a kinetic sequence of events. Mm. So I don't know. I find them quite good fun. Like, I'm probably not the best person to talk to about it, because there's people who's that's their sort of bread and butter.
Yeah.
And probably have deeper thoughts about it, because on the whole, even if I'm doing action sequences, it'll be strewn with jokes what I do. So essentially, I'm still, you know what I mean? It's still, the action will still be serving the jokes.
Yeah. So when you've got your sort of rough assembly, you've pieced everything together, are you one of these editors who likes going through on sort of multiple waves and taking time away from a scene? Or do you like, you know, firing away at it until it's perfect, or, you know, what do you prefer? Was that down to your relationship with the director and what they like?
Yeah, going back to like the sculpting analogy, like I'm sure I don't think you just get a big, you know, raw block of granite and just the first thing you do is just perfectly chisel out the nose, you know, and go, great, that nose is perfect. Now the leg. I get this leg amazing. Like, I think you sort of chisel the edges off and you get something together, and, you know, you sort of don't want to be judged on your first assembles. You want to leave some direction in there, and particularly with ins and outs of scenes, while you're assembling, you know, you're not quite sure how the last scene has ended, and, you know, also you don't necessarily make that many editorial decisions that early on, because you don't want to just go, you know, you've done an assembly, the director's walking into the room, you go, yeah, well, cut a load of lines, you know, that I don't think we need. They're going, what, I haven't seen them? Like, sometimes you might just go, I got rid of a word there. I really don't think we need it. But on the whole, you'll want to show the director what there is. And if you think a line can go, then, you know, you can maybe have the chat rather than go, I've cut half an hour, you know. I don't think you need to see it. So you're probably going to keep everything in. You know, I don't think you're going to completely craft something. I mean, there's certainly what you want to do is get something down so that you can step back and look at it so it can start to come in focus. Because the thing with a movie, and well, in anything that's longer than a couple of minutes, is that, you know, you can edit a scene in isolation again and again and again and think like it's done. And then you watch it in the context of the movie and you go, it's all too quick. And, oh, it needs to be half the length, this, you know, because anything in isolation can be fine, but you know what you're making, you know, you're making a whole hour and a half, so you need to step back. And that's why, sort of pacing wise, it's just hard to tell, and you'll keep stepping back and go, oh no, looser there, and you try not to over tighten everything, but you'll get to a point where you've over tightened an area and you watch it back and you need to loosen it.
It's kind of like learning from negative information, isn't it? Negative information, a lot of directors and people who are not in our part of the craft, it's not 100% apparent to them that actually negative information is just as important as positive information.
Yeah. It's a bit like when you go to see the optician, like you're playing around with cuts, you're better or worse? Now this, is it better?
A
or worse?
E?
Yeah, yeah.
Or worse? What does the third line say?
Exactly, you know, and it's like that thing where they turn the thing around and you just feel like that's you. And you go, it's all right to say it's worse. You know, you go, no, we've gone too far there. Put that two frames back in. I mean, the key thing that I always try, like, I don't really like, I think it's a bit of a crime when a film's too long, because I always remember, I think it, you can be in a film and then you look at your watch and you go, you know, when you come round in the cinema, or you just go, oh, I'm back in the room.
Yeah.
And that seems like a crime to me. And then I also find it, I don't know, there's a few films I've watched and it's too quick. They've gone too quick.
Mm.
So what you're really looking for is just the right pace.
Just make it perfect.
Yeah. Just so just once you've got just the right pace, you know, stop. no, but that's the weird thing. It's all, and the other thing is, you watch films, and when you work on a film, you'll watch them in a really packed, massive cinema. Mm. And the film sometimes might feel a bit quick because lots of people are laughing, and you're thinking, oh, they missed that. And then you'll watch it, the film, in a sort of a one quarter fill with a, you know, subdued crowd, and you go, oh, it should be quicker, this film. No, the holes are not filled by laughter and like. And then, you know, I don't know, some people watch it on a plane. And so there's no, like, universal... It's difficult, like, pace-wise, because things feel different in different places. Yeah, you're looking for not too slow or not too fast.
It's amazing, isn't it? Because it's like looking at a painting. Every single day, you're going to look at it and see something different. You're bringing all that, what happened to you that day, what happened to you this week, whatever. Yeah. It's that personal baggage, emotional baggage of where you are at this precise moment in time and looking at a piece of art, whether it's a film or whatever.
But also, you like, if you're looking at a painting on a massive billboard or on a thumbnail, on a, you know, and you just look at it all these different ways, and, you know, and it's got to be viewable in all those ways.
Yeah.
But yeah, you sort of play around with it, I think,
and
try and find the right pace.
It's such a subjective point of view, really, isn't it?
I mean, there's a thing with comedy of, you know, the quicker something is, the quicker you are to the next laugh. That's, but, you know, it's not all about speed either.
Mm. I mean, what are some of the main problems you get when you're cutting scenes? Is it retiming sync or the continuity or the shot flow? I mean, what are those main things you think? I think young people entering into the industry would be interested to hear about.
Well, the thing is, a lot of things you can identify yourself, but then what's really handy is sort of screenings and notes from other people, because, you know, sometimes you think, oh, there's something you're trying to achieve and you think you've cracked it, and then you play it to a group of people and you ask them, what do you think happened there, you know, and they go, I don't know. Oh god, didn't you get that he was, and No. Oh, Jesus, you know, and you go back to it and you just, like, a lot of the time you think you've done something.
Yeah.
And, you know, people don't get it, or, you know, you're making it for a wide audience. You know, there's always problems with scenes, like continuity or what, you know, small things like that. But, I mean, ultimately, there's some bad continuity that sticks because you just go, well, if I'm going to have that performance, and they are the best takes of those things and we love them, they don't quite cut together. You end up, rather than putting a less good performance in, you stick with the bad continuity.
Mm.
So you'll have problems and you've just got to weigh them all up, really.
Mm.
Paddington Paul was constantly questioning the structure of the movie, even to the point where we all just probably thought, it's fine. And then really late on, Paul came up with a radical structural change that we weren't even sure would work. You go, really? What? So now this is happening that day. That's the day before. That, and you go, and then, okay, well, you know, and everyone was like, it's probably fine, but, you know, we'll try it. And then you go, ah, it's loads better. Who would have thought?
Mm.
So I think it's that never-ending striving to make something better is like quite a difficult thing when you're really tired and want to go home. Like on Paddington, because there was lots of CG, like it took ages for them to fill in the bear, and it was quite a long process. But the advantage of that was you got distance.
Mm.
The scene would go off and then come back months later and you could look at it again and have another go, you know, which you can't always on things.
Just changing directions slightly. I mean, how do you work with music? I mean, how does it work in your types of films? Do you temp score? Do you lay down the music first? How does it work?
Yeah, so on the movies I've worked on, apart from Partridge, because that was a bit different, it was sort of not a... We had a little bit of scoring in Partridge. It was mainly like commercial tracks. We were trying to use commercial tracks.
Mm.
And they weren't always written down what commercial tracks would be where. Like, we used Roxanne by Sting, and I think I'd like heard it at the train station on the way home, thinking, that's the perfect bit. Because there's a bit, there's like a dramatic pause for some dramatic music to come in. And the start of Roxanne is, da da. And then you cut to Lynn, and it's Roxanne. And I thought it was quite funny. Because it's set in the radio station, and you're trying to come up with the right track that seems like it's from a local radio station that sort of works with the drama, and everyone was sort of suggesting stuff on that. And there was a little bit of score, and for temp-wise, I think it was Mark Davis was helping us out doing some additional editing, and he just got the thing, the Morricone soundtrack, and all that is dum-dum, dum-dum.
Mm.
Dum-dum, 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 like really stripped down. Weirdly, I don't know, there was something that just isn't funny about overly... And also the drama was essentially quite small. It's just a man with a gun. It's not, like, too big. And if you put too much score on it, it just made it... Also, Partridge has never had score on it before. It was like, we didn't want to do anything too big or too noticeable. It just had to sort of signify tension. Really, you just patch stuff together out of existing scores, and I think everyone does it, and that's your temp. So, you know, you just go, what scores do we like? You get a load of them together.
I remember that bit there. That would have been, something yeah. like this would be good here, this type of mood. Or whatever.
And generally what you do is, like on, we looked at a lot of Alexander Desplat, who did a lot of Wes Anderson stuff. He's done his score on Grand Budapest is like amazing. Mm. You know,
he's a genius. I mean, he's done some of my favourite scores over the last 5 or 6 years.
You really notice the score without it ruining the mood, like not in a bad way, but you still are in the story and in the moment. I don't know, they're good, aren't they? He's brilliant. We used a lot of his music.
If you're listening, Wes.
I'll send my CV. So I think, you know, on the whole, you just go, I like these scores. This is the type of thing we're going to go for. And you put them in. And then, like, I think on Bunny and the Bull, who I did with Paul as well, is we got loads of different scores and then we put them in. And then it felt like a right mess at the end. So I think we try and get things that go together.
Mm.
I mean, the problem is you're always going to... What will inevitably happen is you always hate your temp score anyway. And that's like a good
good starting
you're meant
point.
Not to like it because somebody's going to come along and create something that you all love and that pulls the movie together, and it's like one voice and one coherent thing. But what you will inevitably have is bits you like that work in isolation that are kind of the right idea. And there will be, you know, you'll always get some temp love for a certain bit. You go, oh, we can never do better than that piece of very famous score, you know. And inevitably, you know, you'll ask somebody to do something that sounds a bit like it. Like, I wouldn't get it in at assembly stage, because you really want to sort of get to the movie a little bit before you start. I mean, it's also just the practicality of, you know, once you're cutting scenes and there's music through it, you've got another couple of layers to fiddle with of complexity. And you sort of want to... Also, you want to focus on, you know, the job at hand a bit. And then once you go, oh, I think this is getting here, let's get some score in. And also, you know, in the early stages, you're still deciding what the structure is of the movie. And once you get a bit closer to that, you can start getting some tracks in. And,
you know, just, we talked a lot about the sort of artistic side of it and the workflow side. You know, what are your theories on, you know, creating the relationship with the director? You know, so you talk to a lot of editors, they say, you know, those first few weeks when you've got them in, you know, director's usually absolutely shattered, you know, might be in a slightly emotional state because of the absolutely crazy hours they've gone through and stuff like that. So they try and make it a lot more nurturing and stuff like that. But, you know, obviously every relationship is different and stuff like that. What's your thoughts on the relationship with the director and how you kind of craft that?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, you want somebody you can get on with. But I think, I don't know, all editors seem to be really easy to get on with. I think it seems to be a quality. I don't think you can be diva or anything. You need to be easy to get on with, because ultimately that somebody's got to spend hours with you in a room. I don't know, there seems to be a quality in everyone. All the editors I meet are quite easy going. It's, you sort of need to sort of fit the director like a glove in a weird way. I don't know if that's the right analogy. But some people will want you to take the lead on certain things more than other people will, and some people will want a lot more control than other people will, you know. So it's sort of, if you go, if the style of director is less hands-on, then you get to fill more voids, you know. I mean, but there is different ways of hands-on. You can be very hands-on but still value your opinion, so you can still, you know, you're still active in it. Some people want, you know, like there are a few people who I haven't really worked with that are, you know, a bit more dictatorial, you know, and less open to suggestion. So, you know, there's like a whole range of directors, and it's just sort of... I mean, the other thing is, if you think something, always say it.
Is that, I mean, that's one of the things, apart from, you know, sitting at the machine and crafting, and that you are being employed to give your opinion.
Yeah, because inevitably, if you don't say it, somebody else will go, oh, do you know what? I think... this, and you, and there's no point you go, yeah, no, me too. Me too. I know I didn't say it, but
I thought
I did like a week ago. And you go, well, so, you know. And the other thing is, if what you say is not right, sometimes you can hone in on a problem, and you know what you think is causing the problem isn't, but you'll get to it, you know. You'll start a dialogue, you go, I think I'm not sure about this, and somebody, and you'll work out, oh, it's not that that's a problem, it, you know, you'll start the dialogue and you'll get there. But always say it, because there's no, and the other thing is, you know, you're inevitably, there's a reason why you're thinking something, and you know, and sometimes you're not right, you know. Sometimes somebody might disagree, or you try out and you go, no, that was a bad idea. But
it's about having,
we
that
can put
confidence.
It back in,
yeah, yeah, that confidence to say something and it not come out right.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, actually, I got that wrong, but that's necessarily a bad thing.
Yeah, and you might get to something else from that wrong thing. You know what I mean? So it might uncover something else. I mean, the thing is, you've got to be, God, like when you're editing and when you're directing all this stuff, you know, the amount of, all you live on is criticism. You know, if you can't take criticism, it's not a good job. Because, you know, you're having to show things that aren't finished. It won't be finished till it's finished. And people go, oh, you know, the amount of people come in and go, oh, it's a bit slow. And a bit, and you go, yeah, because it's the first assemble. I know it's slow, but, you know, you go, and you've got to sort of focus in on what's really useful. But, you know, like similarly, like the director, you've got to remember also the director's sometimes written it, has, you know, had a long relationship with the material before you even see it. So, you know, best not to just go, well, that's rubbish. Or, you know, you're like, you've also got to...
It's that act of diplomacy, really, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's tough criticism, you know. It's tough to take, even when that's the currency of your job, is to, you know, and you want criticism. That's, you don't want to make it in a bubble because it's no good, because you're then just making it for you, and you want to make it work for everybody.
Yeah.
And to be honest, the other thing is, going the other way, is sometimes directors are really down on their stuff and really irreverent and really want to cut everything and want to... And some, you know, so it's, sometimes it's not actually just, you know, not wanting to upset them by saying, by pointing out the imperfection. Sometimes it's going, hey, this is good. No, that's funny. No, let's keep that, you know. And so sometimes it's that, you know, surprisingly.
Are you, I mean, I'm always interested when talking to other editors, are you actually quite a technical editor? Do you know a lot about the software and the buttons and the cables?
Not massively, no. I'm not like technically minded like in... I'm sort of technically minded in like the use of the Avid in like handling effects within it and all, you know. Like, because I started with tapes, like I'm not good at managing files and, you know, if the Mac goes wrong or, you know, I'm not...
You get on the phone.
Yeah, I get on the phone. But with, you know, sort of managing within the Avid itself, I'm pretty happy with, you know, doing quite technical stuff, which, because of the type of stuff I've done, it's been quite effects heavy. You end up just having to, you know, and I've always liked it, really.
Moving on to Paddington now, I mean, awesome movie. Obviously, it's gone on to great success, made hundreds of millions of dollars around the world. You know, I think the one thing, I just recently saw it, loved it. And I think one of the things that, obviously I was drawn in by the story, but then, you know, I was like, oh, wow, this looks really complicated to edit. And I just, you know, it would be great to talk through some of the issues around cutting something, you know, that heavy mix between live action and CG, and what those issues were on a day-to-day basis.
There's no bear there. There's like a little... pole with like a piece of gaffer tape on it to show where they're meant, the actors should look. And for the effects people, there was a woman in a costume who would walk through, who was about the same height as Paddington should be, just for the effects people to see what it looks like. So there's no bear. The dialogue you can change, so you end up rewriting endlessly. So you're you know, everything's shifting all the time. So it's a lot different to having all the performances in the can. You've got the rushes, that's it. The bear doesn't exist yet, so you can do anything. There's still endless possibilities.
But within the constraints of the live action actors have said their lines, but...
Yeah.
So that's locked, but we have to... We can do anything with Paddington and make him say anything we want.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
it has to be within this script structure.
Yeah. Unless you get the actors back on blue screen and pick it up and pop them in.
Right.
Which is also what we did. So there's more writing goes on in the edit suite because the bear doesn't exist, and you go, oh, why didn't he pick up the teapot? So if you come up with any ideas in the edit, they can end up in the story. So it's quite exciting because you can, you know, you're sort of part of the writing process a bit more, and you know, you just get lots of people in and you're open to suggestions because there's a performer that hasn't been made yet. Because the other, what's great is things that, you know, with hindsight, things are great. You can have ideas in hindsight and still make them a reality. It's not too late. So it's exciting from that point of view, but it's, you know, quite work intensive because there's still shifting sands, it's still being written, it's still taking shape. So it means you end up editing a lot more. And also to get the bear to feel like he's there is, you know, you're not just dealing with actors' natural timing who were there together in the room. So that comes together a lot quicker than people who aren't really there. It takes a while to sort of create the illusion and get the timing right because you've got nothing. They weren't in the same room at the same time. And, of course, you've got to put this little bear... You start off with just a little, you know, just a 2D bear, you know, from every angle, you know, with hat on, hat off, happy, sad, shocked, you know, that's about it. And he just floats around, and you put that in to try and get an idea of what it looks like. And then when you're rewriting it, in the early stages, it was mainly Paul's voice. So it's not the proper voice. It's just a cardboard, what looks like a cardboard cutout.
Mm.
And the problem with these things early on is that it, consequently, it doesn't look very good. So people watching go, I don't know.
Something's missing.
Yeah, it's not good yet, is it? And you go, well, no, because the bear... So what that consequently does is it you end up putting yourself under a lot more pressure to keep making it better and better and better. And then when finally the bear's in it, you know, it looks great. But I think it's difficult because you're not, you know, you're dealing with something that is so rough, you know, and it's meant to look so good. It's quite hard to imagine, you know, for everyone. It's just difficult to imagine. So also when you're dealing with pacing, you know, you just go, once we've got a big close-up of this beautiful bear with, you know, with his eyes welling up, with Peru reflected in the background, you go, let's have twice as much of that, maybe. It really is impossible to judge. You know, we gave ourselves quite a hard time early on with judging how long a shot was, because you just want to go, can we have 3 seconds of this frame store? Because obviously changing it is not
highly
ideal.
Highly complex.
But you get it back, and then sometimes you go, oh, do you know what? Now I can see him. We need a second of that. We don't need two.
Mm.
You know, it's just impossible to judge without seeing it. So that's a difficult thing, because what you're doing, you're sort of editing a receptacle for some bear to be made.
Mm.
And then, you know, what you want is rushes, really. And you sort of, you have to order up your rushes, you know, how long you want of each bit, and then take it from there. It's impossible to just get it right first time, unfortunately. We tried a lot, and then
you didn't try putting in a real bear and seeing how that would go.
No. Weirdly, had anything on set look, because they had for a lot of the close-ups, they had a gloved hand, and nothing looked as real as the CG bear. The CG bear looks more real than real.
Mm.
It's really odd.
It's amazing. I mean, I was just looking, you know, constantly trying every single time Paddington came up. I was like studying the complexity and the perfection and the head and the everything and the eyes, and you're like, oh my God, this is amazing.
Well, it's phenomenal. Well, it starts off as like a sort of clay lump that moves around, and there's loads of stages.
Mm.
And they put fur on, and then they add gravity. There are these loads of stages, then lighting, and then they, you know, if he's wet, they'll put moisture on, then he'll start interacting, and then it's ridiculously complicated, but amazing. They did an amazing job.
How long was the edit, actually, just out of interest? How long were you cutting it for?
I think the edit was 13 months.
Wow.
Yeah.
So obviously, you know, being the editor on a big CGI movie like Paddington, you're the head of a department. You know, there's a lot of people working to create your rushes, and, you know, to the dialogue editors and the da 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 da. You know, there's a lot of people. Just talk to me about if you could tell us about the workflow and the team that you had working around you.
Yeah, it's certainly the biggest sort of editorial department I've worked with. So there's a constant flow of effects from, you know, us to Framestore, sending these sort of scenes that are the receptacle to have the bear put in, and then various versions will keep coming back. So there's an enormous traffic, there's a lot of paperwork involved, and, you know, so you've got a VFX supervisor in control of all that. So, and then there's a VFX editor, who's Richard Ketteridge on Paddington. He's done a lot of big VFX movies. He's absolutely amazing. He'll have to rough out the scenes with Paddington moving around, picking stuff up, falling over, doing things with this sort of, like, he's sort of animating with these 2D cutouts that we're supplied with, and, like, he does an amazing job. And it, you know, nobody ever gets to see it, because it gives us the timing, you know. And if we want Paddington to do some action, we'll generally put sound effects in and go, to sort of get an idea of what you want the pace to be, you know, and then Richard will put in. And then you can sort of, you can roughly see, you can start to imagine what it'll look like in it. So it really helps that it's, you know, at least he's moving around and appear vaguely doing the action, but it's like the most basic animation you've ever seen.
Mm.
So there's Richard, the VFX editor. It's a full-time job with the traffic going backwards and forwards. Oh, God, and the paperwork. And every re-speed we do on a shot, he, like, has to like just the paperwork involved is ridiculous. Like it's you know, it's full on these movies. And then he had an assistant as well, who was Henry Kemblin. And then there was the edit assistant who just deals with the assisting on the editing, Fiona D'Souza. And then she had an assistant as well, so even a second assistant editor. It was Tom Sainty at the end. And I think we've had a few people before that. It's such a long job.
Yeah.
And then we had, you know, extra people helping us out as well. So it sounds like quite a big department. But to be honest, I don't think it was a particularly big department on a film this size.
Yeah, so in a kind of heavy CGI movie, you know, is it a lot tighter on the pre-visualization than normal drama?
Well, they use pre-vis to plan things a lot more, because you sort of, once you do the pre-vis, you can then work backwards and go, well, what plates do we need to put the bear in? Because Paddington is, he's a CG bear in a real environment on the whole. So there's always going to be some real element. So you can plan out scenes. There's a scene where it's entirely animated where he goes up the ventilation shaft with two dustbusters. Yeah. So once he's in there, it's entirely animated. I mean, it's all so brilliant, you'd never know. You know, it doesn't look like, oh, wow, here's the animated sequence. I mean, it's just phenomenal. You can't really tell what's animated and what isn't these days. So that really is, you know, you get the previs, you edit it a bit, but really it's all animation side. There's not, the editing sort of goes over to them a bit, you know, apart from you go, can we have longer on that? And can we do this? And, you know, so you're, as the editor and the director, you're sort of directing the animators to edit it. And then the rest... Peru, there was a bit of previs in Peru with the three bears.
So that's the first couple of scenes in the movie.
Yeah, and similarly, you sort of cut with those to come up with your shots, and then, you know, then they have to go off and shoot the plates. So there was quite a bit of previs, but on the whole, scenes where it's just family talk to bear, you don't need previs, you just put the bear in. You know, the bear's just another character in a scene. You know, it's just he doesn't happen to be there, but you decide where he is. So it's only really sort of action scenes, because I think it was the chase where Paddington's going through Portobello Road Market on a skateboard, and he goes up in the air and flies around and various people see him. So things like that, you know, action sequences, they previs.
You get like candles on some of the effects, on the effect shots that you get back. You've got a lot to play with in terms of.
You don't,
because obviously it's very expensive to, you know, each frame is.
It's quite difficult to work out how long things need to be anyway at that stage. And so initially you get 3 second handles when it's very rough. You know, there's different stages of bear. First, he just looks like a clay blob, and then he gets more and more complicated as they lock into the action and hone the bear. You know, finally towards the end he'll start to have fur, but it's, you know, and it's not till, weirdly, his eyes are always dead until right at the end, and then there's suddenly a spark and you go, oh, he's alive. And as the bear develops, you have less and less flexibility in his movement, because they keep it very broad strokes to start off with. You're literally looking for his trajectory and the space he will, so he floats about and you go, is he going to move? Is that about the trajectory? Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Then it'll be footfalls and action, and, you know, they build it up. And as they build it up, your handles generally get less.
Yeah.
And because you pay for all that rendering and extra stuff.
Yeah, so that's a huge amount of...
Yeah, I mean, it's something like it takes about 24 hours to render a frame, was the weird thing. I think they've got loads of render engines and like that. But, yeah, you do start off with handles, so you have flexibility, and then inevitably what happens towards the end, if you suddenly realise you want something longer when you've only got a few frames handles, it's like a really big deal to go beyond that. And a few times we were told, no, you can't have any more. It's too late. And you're, oh, no, well. Like, it really is difficult, because you can't just, you know, normally you're constantly slipping and sliding things for... based on pace. And the problem is with your bear shots, they slowly want to narrow you down to just save money, which is not unreasonable, because it would cost a fortune to keep all the handles long.
Of course, yeah.
But you're slowly being backed into a corner. But it's not so bad, because as you go on, really the flexibility you need is hopefully less and less. But you get to a point, have we got any handles there? No. Oh. What about the other end? No. Okay, well, I guess we'll leave it. Or you just make the call, and towards the end they would, you know, I think we'd used up all our flexibility because it's, you know, it's a big deal for them.
Yeah, massive. I mean, Framestore just doesn't get any bigger than that in terms of effects houses, does it? They are amazing.
Yeah, they're enormous and they're really amazing. But you know, they have to give you deadlines to make it workable.
Of course,
for them.
Yeah.
They can't give you endless flexibility,
mm.
which is understandable. But obviously, you ask.
You got to ask.
You got to ask.
You always got to ask. You always know. Ask.
And it's, you know, sometimes they say yes.
So just, I'd love to know, how long was your first cut of Paddington?
Of Paddington? Well, the weird thing is, Paddington wasn't actually that long. It was quite tight. I can't remember. I think it was like about 95 minutes or something, because we came down to... Well, what you've got to remember is, so I think the film is 95 minutes, but with an effects film, you'll have 6 minutes of end credits.
Yeah.
That's added, maybe more. It might even be eight, because you've got hundreds and hundreds of animators.
I sat in the cinema for quite a long time after the movie ended, watching every single name. I was like,
it's
wow.
Phenomenal.
That's a team.
Yeah, because you had, I think there were literally 300 people from Framestore in London and Montreal.
Wow.
The duration, you know, so your first assembly duration never has the credits on. So I think we were about 95 minutes at first assemble, because I mean we always wanted a tight movie, and like there wasn't a lot of overwriting, or I mean there's no improvisation.
Yeah.
Because you can't really do that when you've got an animated bear. And the other thing, like one of the things they do is like lighting, is they will map everything that moves around in the room that isn't the bear. So to light the bear accurately, if Mrs. Bird walks past, like I've seen this computer, like they map the room, the virtual room, map where the lights are. And then if Miss Bird walks past, there's like a wireframe animation of Miss Bird walking past so that they can simulate the light properly of that character.
Yeah.
So it's not only modelling what you can see, they model the whole room of stuff that's already there so that the light will interact properly.
Yeah.
Like, it's insane. Like, you just would not... But it's just insane, the level that they do. What was the question again?
I can't remember, actually.
It was...
it was very interesting. How long was the first cut? I mean, did it spiral out of... Did it start long? Did it get short? Did it...
Well, no. So my point was that I think Paul always wanted... Like, Paul's ideal was about a 90-minute film. Because we wanted it to be quick and entertaining. And also, you know, you don't want a children's movie that's, you know, 2 hours.
Yeah.
Because of attention spans for the whole family.
Yeah.
I think what, in direct comparison, there was the first assemble of the Alan Partridge movie, which was a very long script. And what they do is they get, I think it's Armando's sort of signature thing, is just get loads of really funny material in a script. Don't worry about getting it down too much, you know.
Yeah.
And we'll see what's great and we'll cherry pick in the edit. So I think Partridge was, conversely, it was like a 3-hour assembly.
Wow. Because that was actually, wasn't much over 90 minutes, the final film, was
it? No. We got it at like a 95, 100 or something minutes.
But the first cut was...
Yeah, it was 3 hours
literally
long.
Double.
And it wasn't slow and it wasn't difficult to watch because Steve's performance drives everything.
Yeah.
So your first cuts were still tight and quick because Steve's got this amazing energy and his timing is don't hang around. You know, he drives the scenes. So consequently, because he's in everything, it wasn't a baggy cut. It was really watchable. It was just that... you know, when you watch things, you just get a sense that, hey, the first act is too long. This is all good material. I just need to be progressing into, this is a great scene, but at this point in the movie, I want to get on.
Yeah.
And it's just judging stuff like that. And, you know, sometimes you can just judge it also on that bit's funnier than that bit. Let's just do that. I mean, there's so many big cuts in that film that you just we got away with. Quite a few bits where, you know, Steve's on one side of the room and you cut and he's on the other, but you sort of cut in such a way you try not to highlight that, obviously. Yeah.
But it must have been, actually, you know, that, you know, if you're watching a 3-hour cut of something and it's tight and then you go, right, well, over the next few months we've got to cut this in half or at least at least get it right down. There must have been some moments where you're like, oh no, I'm sad to lose that.
No, not really. Not really, to be honest. No, but the thing is with comedy is, you know, hopefully if you're at such a level, it's all actually funny.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You're not just getting rid of howlingly bad jokes. Like, if you're working at a certain level, it's all funny. You know, but it's not all about that. It's about, you know, sacrificing B jokes.
Yeah.
To get the story moving. Like, I don't think we ever cut something that was just stone cold, wow. You know, this is, I can't believe you're cutting this. There was a couple of things that were nice.
Yeah.
But to be honest, I think if you watch something and you go, wow, this is really watchable now, I think that's an exciting, good thing.
Yeah.
You know, not to go, oh no, how do we get it down? Because you just go, wow, what we're dealing with is it's all watchable material. We've just got to navigate our way through it.
Yeah.
And, you know, yeah, it was sort of nearly 90, it was an hour, 100 minutes again, 95-ish. With less credits this time, so there's more film in that than, say, Paddington. And the other thing is Steve would just constantly keep writing more jokes on the day. So
this is a constantly evolving thing. And
well, just get loads and loads of jokes in there. That's what it's all about. That's the currency of comedy, you know. You know, that's a great instinct. And just work out whether you can have them later, you know. It's great to have them in the bag. I seem to remember one day when I think Deck thought he was coming in to shoot a... Declan Lowney, the director, thought he was coming in to shoot a 3-page scene. And I think it was 7 because they'd been up all night writing more jokes. You know, and cutting it, I was like laughing all day long. Like I genuinely was laughing all day long, you know. Yeah. You get to see the stuff and he's so, you know, just so funny and so much energy. And I don't know how he kept it up all day, but he, you know, drives that movie. And really just working out how to get it down. Just fun, really. It was funny from the get-go, you know.
Yeah. So, I mean, what's it like editing with all these big stars like Nicole Kidman and Simon Pegg and Steve Coogan and stuff like that? It must be really fun. I mean...
It's great, yeah. It's great sort of seeing their performances, but often, you don't often meet... You know, everyone does say, oh, what are they like? What's... You know, and you go, I don't know, I was in the edit suite all the time. So it's great seeing their performances and seeing how they work. And, you know, it's a great honour to sort of work with sort of great performers, you know. And, you know, when you get into the edit, you realise, you know, why they're held in such high esteem because they're really, you know, really brilliant at their job. And that does make it easier for you. But, yeah, you don't often meet them. I mean, Steve did come in and he's just... has a big input on the edit and, you know, even in the edit, trying to add more jokes, more like it's just a constantly trying to add more jokes, make new jokes, just, you know, all the time. Let's keep, you know, and it's a really good instinct to have. And that's why what he does is really funny with loads and loads of jokes.
Yeah, it's amazing.
But, you know, there's a bit of stress with comedy, you know, because people, they want it to be really good.
Mm.
Their necks are on the line. You know, there's nothing worse than not being funny in a comedy. So there can be a bit of stress in the edit suite, you know, and you've got to, you know, you've got to, in some cases, you've got to sort of win people over a bit, you know, that they trust you with their performance. There's also a big thing with comedy of, you know, have you selected the right take? Have you selected the funniest take? So sometimes early on with people, they can be, show me the other ones.
Mm.
And you go through and you hope that you selected the funniest one, and then they go, yeah, yeah, keep that one, and you go, yeah, yeah, I did it. Phew. I did get the right. I can tell, you know, and that's like a thing, you know, because you know a lot of the time it's just you there to go through and select the funniest take. Sometimes it's a bit of a grey area and matter of opinion, and you'll change takes. The other thing is sometimes as the whole thing comes into focus, you reassess the takes, which ideally what you'll always have time to do, and you just go, do you know what, now I've got more of a sense of this scene. I think that's a better way to go, you know. And I think that's probably true with drama as well as comedy. But on the whole, if there's a certain joke, you generally know which is funny. Although, weirdly, in Steve Coogan's... The way Steve works is... sort of not quite like anyone else. Steve, I've never known anyone who can deliver a line 14 different ways equally as funny in just with different intonations.
Really?
Different. Yeah, it's just
wow. Is this the process of evolution? Is it is he getting into something?
Yeah, no. What he will do is there will be an evolution in the earlier takes as he builds up and finds a performance.
Mm.
This is this is what I've seen on Partridge. He sort of there's an evolution in working it out, and then he hits his stride, and then you'll start to use all those takes from that point. But the delivering 14 takes all in different ways, it's funny. I think
wow.
he is just an expert in thinking of different ways that are equally funny. Do it, so you're really spoiled for choice. Like he's just a comedy machine,
Mm.
And then, like on the Boosh, Noel and Julian would do a thing where they would just run a line and let they would do 10 different versions, but they would properly improv it. They would do a different one every time,
mm.
and then so you'd have a different thing with them, which is the funniest. And what you have to do is just go with what you find funny.
Mm.
You can't get too intellectual about it. You just go with the one that made you laugh, and even if your only explanation is "don't know why, it's just funny." and that's what
you're the first audience.
Yeah, exactly. You're the first audience, and you just go for what makes you laugh. Because if you over intellectualize it, you might end up talking yourself out of the funny one and putting something else in.
Mm.
But yeah, as regards to what any advice on picking the funniest bit, I don't know. just pick what you find funny. Just trust your instincts.
Mm, fantastic. So, final question. What advice would you give to young editors or, filmmakers, editors trying to get into the industry?
What, how to get in?
Yeah. Well, things to be doing and stuff like that.
I think constantly be editing something, because while you're trying to get in, you can at least still get better. You don't have to... there's no point not doing anything. And, oh, damn, I need to get in before I can start. You can edit anywhere.
Mm.
If you can edit on use industry standard.
What, software? Or?
Yeah, I mean, is that the industry standard? Or it's Final Cut Pro and Avid, isn't it? That's what is used in the industry. It seems to all be Avid from where I am.
Mm.
And I don't think, you never look at a sequence and go, oh, it's got Avid written all over it. That I can tell that's cut and Avid. Or, oh, it's definitely cut on Final Cut this, you can tell. Ultimately, it doesn't matter. Even if you've cut something on iMovie or your phone or whatever, it sort of doesn't actually matter. But it's handy if you know how to use all the equipment the industry already has. Mm. and you can do that wherever. Just find a way. But with regards to, with getting in, it's difficult. Everyone always says that, and everyone gets in a different way. And there's no... set route. You can go and make tea somewhere and get in. There's just the other thing is nepotism's great. If you've got a relation who's in the industry, that's a really good in. I didn't have that. I just exploit whatever you've got really, and what's around you and what you can get to, because there are so many ways in. You don't have to go to film school, you don't have to go to college, but if that's available to you, and if there are facilities or filmmakers you just improvise, adapt and overcome, really. It's I don't think there's any... Everyone's got a different route.
Mark, thank you so much for joining us here on Inside the Edit, and it's been hugely entertaining, and best of luck in the future.
Pleasure. I just feel sorry that you've got to go through this interview and edit this all down. That's all I've been thinking.
Well, we're all editors here.
Yeah.
Okay. Cheers, mate.
Thanks, dude.